Good evening and welcome to Leeds University, which this year is celebrating its centenary. We're here for the fourth in the current series of Wreath Lectures. An audience of academics, students, writers, politicians and people of the theatre have joined us in a modern auditorium created out of the old Leeds Playhouse. Our lecturer is one of the university's most distinguished alumni, the poet, playwright, political activist and winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, Wole Soyinka. He came here from his native Nigeria to study English in the mid-50s and maintained strong links with the city and the university ever since. His play, The Beatification of Area Boy, was staged at the new West Yorkshire Playhouse here in Leeds on the night in 1996 when his fellow countryman, the writer Ken Sarawiwa, was executed in Nigeria. Professor Soyinka has endured his own share of suffering in his homeland. He was held for 2 years in solitary confinement, and only in recent years has he been free to travel between his adopted place of exile, the United States, and his African home. So far in this lecture series, he's explored the symptoms and causes of the terror which threatens the world today. Tonight, he talks about the quest for dignity, a quality which he believes could help us to emerge from this current climate of fear. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome our Wreath Lecturer 2004, Wole Soyinka.
Thank you very much. The Times newspaper of London, Saturday, February 21 this year, carried the story of the suicide of a teenager in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Apparently, it should have been a double suicide, but that youth, after yet another bout of humiliation from his tormentors, decided that he simply could not wait. He was one of a close-knit group of seven, the report continues, who had attended school together and continued to spend all their spare time together. Of the seven, only two still survive. The motor accident that earlier took the lives of three of them may not have been deliberate, but it is on record that one of those three had once attempted suicide. All lived in fear of some degrading punishment by the local vigilantes known as the INLA. In one case, a 14-year-old boy, suspected of being a police informer, was tarred and feathered, dragged through the streets, then kneecapped, that is, shot through the back of the knee, crippling the youth for life. Here's what a counseling psychiatrist in North Belfast had to say. In a culture where it is acceptable for a young man to be dragged down an alleyway and shot, children grow up believing that there is no such thing as respect for human dignity. They often develop anxiety and a fatalistic approach to their own lives. Now, why did the psychiatrist settle on the word dignity over others in his clinical notebook? We're trying to get to grips with the concept dignity and why it appears to mean so much to the sentient human, almost right from childhood. Why has it been entrenched in so many social documents across cultures, civilizations, and political upheavals? Why was it given such prominence in the Charter that resulted from one of the bloodiest revolutions in human history? The French was further enshrined in the document for the enthronement of peace after World War II, the Declaration of Universal Human Rights. In one form or the other, the quest for human dignity has proved to be one of the most propulsive elements for wars, civil strife, and willing sacrifice. Yet, the entitlement to dignity, enshrined among these human rights, does not aspire to being the most self-evident essential needs for human survival, such as food or physical health, compared to that other candidate for the basic impulse of human existence, self-preservation. It may even be deemed self-indulgent. Considerations of this intangible bequest, human dignity, often remind me of a rhetorical outburst in the United Nations by a Nigerian representative. No, that desperate rhetoric did not lead to hysteria, as identified in an earlier lecture, except one chooses to remark the barely suppressed hysterical laughter in the hallowed halls of the General Assembly. The occasion was the arraignment of Nigeria before the Assembly on charges of violations of human rights and the denial of democracy to the people. In what he must have considered the definitive argument on the subject, he challenged his listeners to combat in more or less the following words. What exactly is this democracy that we're talking about? Can we eat democracy? The government is trying to combat hunger, put food in people's stomachs, and all we hear is democracy, democracy. Does it prevent hunger? Is it something we can put in the mouth and eat like food? Well, I felt bound to come quite unnecessarily to the defense of the United Nations and wrote an article in response. I remarked that I had dined in the cafeterias and restaurants of the United Nations on a number of occasions, and I never come across democracy on the menu, or indeed on any menu in restaurants all over the world. So what I demanded was the point of that statement. Well, democracy as such may not be on the UN restaurant menu, it is nonetheless on its catering agenda. So is human dignity. Needless to say, both are inextricably linked. Indeed, human dignity appears to have been on everyone's menu from the most rudimentary society and recognized as such by philosophers who've occupied their minds with the evolution of the social order. Nothing is more fascinating, but permanently contentious, than the kind of binarism attributed to the motoring force of this evolution by Hegel, Nietzsche, Hobbes, and Locke, among others. The historic man, according to them, would appear to be a product of a choice between abject submission or bondage, on the one hand, for the sake of self-preservation, and on the other, a quest for dignity, even if this leads to death. Karl Marx, on his part, felt compelled to distance himself from their deductions. Yet even he refused to ignore the importance of that element, human dignity, naming it as a reward that comes naturally with the evolution of man whose labor is ungoverned by necessity. That is the phase when it becomes possible to celebrate the dignity of labor. What is worth noting for us today is simply the prodigious output of numerous minds on this theme, nearly all of which emphasize that the pursuit of dignity is one of the most fundamental defining attributes of human existence. Now, we can hardly conceive of the individual outside the membership of a socialized group that constantly reinvents itself not as some static organism under observation in a permanently controlled setting. Thus, it is within human relationships that the essence of a human attribute such as dignity is most meaningfully sought, not within the self as some mystic endowment, but as a product of social interaction. It is futile to seek evidence of dignity in the life of an anchorite communing in the wilderness with only birds, reptiles, and the elements for company. In other words, the essence of dignity that is unique to humanity is manifested through the relations of one human being to another, one human being to the family, clan, or community, in the relations between one collectivity and another, however defined, including race relationships. Regarding this context of relationships, however, one common reductionism that courts dismissal is that of conduct under suffering. Superficially, acceptance or resignation may appear to convey dignified bearing. Would we, however, place the victim of torture or of rape within this category? Definitely. What the very act of violation achieves is to rob the victim of that inherent, individualized yet social property that answers the name of dignity. Something is taken away with the act of violation, and that innate entitlement is not restored by one's ability to fulfill social or theological expectations that belong to fortitude. There is no such thing as a dignified slave, with or without the tiring and feathering that appears to have been appropriated for Irish youths in that territory of unrelenting enemy. When the being that is labeled slave acquires dignity, he has already ceased to be a slave. The Yoruba have a saying, Ikuyage sinlo. This translates literally as sooner death than indignity. It's an expression that easily finds equivalents in numerous cultures and captures the essence of self-worth, the sheer integrity of being that animates the human spirit, and the ascription of equal membership of the human community. Now, this does not in any way belittle other humane virtues, integrity, love, tenderness, graciousness, generosity, and indeed the spirit of self-sacrifice. Dignity, however, appears to give the most accessible meaning to human self-regarding. Its loss in many cultures, Japan most famously, makes even death mandatory, exile coming as a second best. To offer some intimation at this stage of our ultimate destination, let us remind ourselves that as with individuals, so it is with communities and nations. Equally, to identify with a community beyond the self is to take upon oneself the triumphs and humiliations, the glories and mortifications that the larger entity undergoes. The very development and maturation of self-consciousness implicates the absorption into the self of that community or association, the alma mater, social clubs, honor societies, the professional register, etc., etc. Through a variety of habits, tastes, social interactions, profession, even hobbies, one acquires or is inducted into a new family, an extension of the self that may actually come to take precedence over even the immediate family and community into which one is born and earns a living. I think of this sense of belonging as community with a capital C, a community of thought, values, and sensibilities, one that, like the quasi-state, transcends boundaries and governments. Often, community is founded on shared historical experience, which may be negative, such as political or economic bondage or marginalization. And finally, let us not forget or underestimate the community that is religion. Dignity in the management of community lies at the heart of our preoccupation. The global climate of fear owes much to the devaluation or denial of dignity in the intersection of communities, most notably between the stronger and weaker ones, an avoidance of emphasis on this very entitlement, this craving, this inbred addiction, if you prefer, in chambers of negotiations, compromises, cold statistics, and resolutions, including within the United Nations. It's enough to speak of or even condemn the building of concrete walls that turn peoples into prisoners in glorified camps, but somehow the expression of one critical, implicit denial is itself denied, and that is dignity. Such a wall reaches beyond its physical terrain, and it's experienced as a gesture of disdain against the community of which such a people form a part. If the Berlin Wall was held to reduce the inherent dignity of a people, since it circumscribed their freedom, then a wall in Palestine cannot be viewed with the same regard as is elicited today by the Great Wall of China. Here's an anecdote from real life, an attempt at breaking out from a different kind of walling in, this time of the economic, but not at any price. About 6 years ago, I was approached by a Cuban ambassador with whom I developed a warm relationship. He felt that I might know some influential individuals within the United States government or intellectual circles that relate to that government. His own government, he stated, was anxious for a resolution of the state of undeclared war between the two nations. These formal and informal probes are part of public knowledge, so I'm not revealing any privileged communication. Now, Cuba had weathered the general economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. reasonably well, he said, but after the infamous Torricelli Act, which extended the ban on trade with Cuba even to her existing foreign partners, that small island began to feel the economic stress of claustrophobia and sought diplomatic means of breaking the deadlock. The ambassador said, Cuba was ready to meet and talk with the U.S. on any platform, formal or informal, no preconditions. Oh, except one. Cuba would not compromise her dignity. It struck me as a remarkable statement even then. We're a small people, he declared. We're powerless compared to the United States, but we will not compromise our dignity. We would rather starve to death. That declaration by my friend, we shall not sacrifice our dignity, is very much the language of nations or states to one another. For instance, during conflict negotiations or their aftermath, and I refer here to those unpublicized sessions familiar to arbitrators, a phrase, an insistent minimal appeal, surfaces with remarkable constancy, even when all else has been surrendered. It goes thus, please, let us leave these negotiating chambers at the very least with our self-respect. It's very much the historic cry of a defeated people, defeated either through a passage of arms or on the diplomatic field. When they discover that they have nothing left, no more bargaining chips, what their representatives are saying is simply, the very least you must concede is that we leave this place not as slaves of imposition, but as partners of consent. Yes, we're compelled to make peace. We accept that we must submit to force majeure, but do leave us at least our self-respect. That is the motivation behind every formula of diplomatic contrivances that is sometimes described as face-saving. Dignity is simply another face of freedom, and thus the obverse of power and domination, that axis of human relationship that is equally sustained by fear. Its poles are doomed to remain in permanent conflict, yet they complement each other. I shall expand on an experience that I narrated in the first of these series, The Changing Mask of Fear, where I commented on the emotional state of my neighbors when we were confronted by a raging fire in California that threatened to consume our homes and indeed cast doubts on our very survival if we lingered too long in its path. I try to contrast the feeling of helplessness that one encounters when nature herself is the force of domination, as opposed to when any human, an equal of others in most ways, takes on the role of dominance and robs one of the faculty of volition. The human response in face of such a menace is, I'm certain, near universal. Observe no sense of reduction in self-esteem, no conduct that equated in dignity, despite the fact that we were impotent in the face of this assailant. This was nature at work, and with awesome power that annihilated all that lay before it. The power that is exerted by nature does not humiliate. Indeed, not even the daily precarious habitation in the shadow of a rumbling volcano, as in the case of Mount Etna, that in the recent decade sent its inhabitants scurrying yet again for safety, or the earthquake that recently devastated parts of Turkey and lately Iran, none of these remotely attains the reduction of individual self-worth as the condition of arbitrary control by another. Those citizens of California who live along the St. Andreas Fault, that is, live with the consciousness of arbitrary seismic eruption, are unfazed by the possibility of death whenever the earth decides to challenge their rights of occupancy. In the Caribbean, the islanders are inured to hurricanes and the accompanying floods. Mudslides occasionally wipe out ancient habitations and bury thousands, later to be dug up in grotesque shapes of mortality. The Philippines recently joined the ranks of these entombed casualties. None of these victims, however, can be said to exist in fear of humiliation or loss of dignity. The kind of power that reduces our self-worth ranges through the most mundane, even domestic relationships, such as fear of ejection of a tenant by a landlord in a system that offers neither preventive measures nor legal redress, to a wife or child subjected to physical and mental abuse by husband or parent, or an Irish teenager in the grip of terror of a vigilante committee, a Zimbabwean recruit in the burgeoning terror training camps of a Robert Mugabe, where some are raped as a mandatory rite of induction. The kind of power that humiliates is that which compels the head of a Palestinian family to sit helplessly under Israeli guns, drenched in tears, as he watches his ancestral olive grove, the sole family source of livelihood, fall under the electric saw, tree by tree, to make way for the very wall that will, from then on, reduce his space of volition. Or else, wake up suddenly in the middle of the night to find strangers in your bedroom. A battering ram has knocked a huge hole in your wall, and a group of armed men are hustling you, your wife, and your children into a holding pen. Such experiences must rank as the ultimate erosion of one's self-esteem. The diet of the average Palestinian in the Middle East today, for this is where we're headed, the table fare of the average citizen is that forced diet of indignity that even children swallow daily. And worse still, watch their parents undergo encounters that denigrate their very humanity. The reality of this territory of collective indignity can be studied close by anyone who can make the pilgrimage, one that is attested by United Nations agencies on the ground, by humanitarian groups that are constantly involved and find themselves sometimes at risk, a zone that is at the very heart of today's climate of fear. In April 2002, at the invitation of the Palestinian writer Mahmoud Darwish, I formed part of a delegation of the Paris-based International Parliament of Writers, now known as the International Network of Cities of Asylum, that visited both Israel and Palestine. We were there both to convey our solidarity to the imprisoned writers, artists and intellectuals on both sides, imprisoned, that is, by circumstances that defeated even their customary borderless vision, and to bear direct witness to what we saw, what was said, and what might be expected. I shall sum up my apprehension of the Palestinian situation in one word: humiliation. No, it was not because one of our Palestinian guides, who kept on repeating, "We want to live in peace with Israeli, but let them at least grant us our dignity." It was not because the word cropped up at least 100 times in street encounters and during the concert of music and poetry that took place in the ancient theater of Ramallah, later to be razed by Israeli, as the film that was made of that journey amply testifies. No, it was simply something that I witnessed myself on this journey of inquiry and affected me so intensely that I could hardly wait to share my disquiet with that Israeli leader for whom I've developed an enormous respect after several encounters, Shimon Peres. He received us, the then president of the association, Russell Banks, and myself, in his office, straight from the airport from a visit to China, while we came in directly from a visit to the Shatila camp. We spoke candidly, and I said to him, "What I saw, what I read on the faces of Palestinians young and old, was humiliation. I encountered a people who seemed devoid of hope for peace, yet desperate for restoration of their human dignity. José Saramago, the Portuguese novelist and Nobel Prize winner, was even more graphic. Indifferent to his popular standing in Israel, he used a metaphor from concentration camps that continues to ring round European literary and intellectual circles even a full year afterwards. Saramago's intent has been much misunderstood, being considered insensitive and hyperbolic by many, including from within our own rank of literary witnesses. But the very fact that this comparison was wrung out of a friend of the Israeli literary constituency contains its own lesson and is one that cannot be ignored except at peril. I witnessed the reality of this humiliation in domestic settings on which the contempt of an occupying force had been visited. I witnessed it at checkpoints. I heard it in numerous recitations of personal experiences across all classes, in numerous episodes on the campus of Birz Zeit University. Most depressing of all, I read it in the eyes of the young, where humiliation had hardened into a resolve not to abandon that ineffable possession, dignity, the loss of which would finally affirm the nullification of their human status. Most frightening of all, I saw it congealed into a hard, cold, unremitting hatred. Yes, I understood the counterclaims of Shimon Peres, his legitimate anger at what he read as the treachery of the Palestinian leader, Yasser Arafat, over that leader's repudiation of a negotiated agreement with the former Prime Minister, Barak, in Camp David. And I acknowledge the weight of responsibility that rests on a leader whose primary mission must be to shield his people from attacks that have raised the barometer of terror through the relentless use of suicide bombers. Nevertheless, it was clear to me that on his part, this astute Israeli leader, perhaps the most thoughtful of past Israeli leaders, did not truly grasp, or else deeply underestimated, the factor of humiliation and the human attachment to that contentious possession, dignity. The Republic of the Disillusioned expands by the day. The recruits into its army have abandoned all hope of justice from within and without, but remain committed to one all-consuming pursuit, dignity. As that goal recedes, they come to lose, like the Irish youth, all faith in a universal concept of human dignity and become indifferent to the moralities and restraints that hold up the scaffolding of civilized coexistence. These are the willing recruits to the army of terror, the harmless neighbor, the shy but pleasant young man or woman who helps with putting out the garbage and wishes you a good morning. Behind that friendly good morning at a shopping mall, however, may lurk the sardonic smile that is powered by secret knowledge of a terminal goodbye. The quasi-state, we know, sometimes overlaps and interlocks with community and seeks to take it over. The critical mass is the point at which one can no longer be distinguished from the other, and the overrun community is seen to appear to bow totally to the control of the quasi-state, if only for a measure of preservation of its own identity. The responsibility that we owe ourselves is to prevent the attainment of that critical mass that then pits one community against another. No community dares succumb to an arrogation of power over the lives of its innocents. Yet, even as we build protective ramparts and pursue the violators of such a basic norm to the ends of the earth, we can aspire to an all-inclusive community that expands beyond the immediate and addresses the genesis of the current climate of fear, not as abstraction, but as reality within the compass of redress. That genesis will be found right within the smoldering heart of the Middle East, a confluence of multiple civilizations within which are nestled the most influential spiritualities of the world, the Judaic, Christian, and Islamic. The dispersal of the climate of fear rests, therefore, on a just solution in the Middle East. It has been said often enough, it cannot be disputed. The time for evasion is over. Yes, we dare not succumb to acts that unilaterally abrogate our own rights to dignity and life. Acts that left such a flaming imprint so recently on the railway tracks of Madrid that they flashed across my mind a moment in the career of fascism. That was when a general astray in the Spanish Cortes spat the shout of "Long live death" in the face of the humanist philosopher Unamuno. That banner of morbidity appears to have been hoisted all over the world. To take it down, the world must act in concert and with resolve to bring our violators to justice, but must also embrace or intensify a commitment to the equalizing principle of that same justice that ensures that the dispossessed enjoy restitution and the humiliated are restored to dignity. Thank you very much.
Wale, thank you very much indeed for that. So there you have Professor Shoyinka's recipe for dissipating the climate of fear. The restoration of dignity to the Palestinians would be a very good place to start, he suggests. But who should do the starting? Isn't the restoration of dignity to the dispossessed exactly what the Americans are trying to do in Iraq? Why doesn't the world seem capable of acting in concert, as Wally calls, even in the face of ongoing outrageous acts of terrorism? Well, those are the kinds of issues, as you've heard, that are raised here tonight. They may be, they may not be the kinds of issues that you'd like to put questions about. I hand the floor to you, gentlemen there.
Albie James from Leeds Metropolitan University. Wally, I think most of us here know the adage by Edmund Burke, the only thing necessary for evil to flourish is for good men to do nothing. Your lecture this evening seems to be an exhortation to good men and women to do something, and that something is to do with human dignity. But what do you do when the hand of friendship offered by good men and women is often rejected by fanatics? How do you turn the fanatics around?
You're talking about the religious leaders who encourage the suicide bombers.
Absolutely.
Yes, I think different grades of enemies, you will admit. When you stretch out the hand of friendship, there are those who turn their backs on the hand. And there are those who slap the hand away. And there are those who take out their knives and chop off your hand. Now, I believe that we must distinguish between those kinds of responses and do what we can to woo those who merely turn their backs. Those who take out the machete and chop off your hand, I think you better use the other hand to deal with them in the appropriate way. But definitely the door towards dialogue, a word which, you know, I use quite often, cannot be closed against the potential of reducing the intensity of hostility and thereby reducing the climate of terror, which actually recruits more and more people into the army. There are those who, whether we like it or not, I agree with you, if you like, sworn enemies. They are irredeemable because they have taken a position and that position is totally unshakable. And believe me, they must be brought to justice because they have assaulted humanity.
Gentlemen there.
My name's Ian Goldman. I'm the president of the Leeds Jewish Representative Council. Professor, you seem to take it for granted that Israel is responsible for what you call the humiliation of the people living in Gaza and the West Bank. Israel's a very small country. It's barely the size of Wales, and it's half desert. Egypt alone, for example, is 50 times bigger than Israel. It's hemmed in by Arab states, and it has people living on its borders who are still committed to its obliteration. And yet it's offered to trade some of the little land it has for a just peace. My questions to you are these. To what extent have the people living in Gaza and the West Bank contributed to their own humiliation and loss of dignity by spurning Israel's attempts to offer a just peace? And what responsibility is borne by the millions of Arabs living in the states surrounding Israel who've done nothing constructive to solve the problems by absorbing the Palestinian people and by influencing them to renounce violence?
Right. You said that I seem to imply that Israel is responsible solely for the humiliation of the Palestinian people. I think it's more than Israel. I think the international community has contributed to the humiliation of the Palestinian people. How many resolutions, for instance, have been passed by the United Nations? See, there cannot be double standards in the interaction of communities. Otherwise, we have a total state of anomy, international anomy. If we accept the fact that we have this global arbiter, and that arbiter passes resolutions after resolutions, and those resolutions are ignored without sanctions, without very terse action, then the Palestinians feel humiliated, not just by Israel, but by the international community. So it's not just Israel who's responsible. The international community has been applying double standards in the Middle East.
The gentleman also asked about the surrounding Arab nations. I mean, what part do you think they play? They haven't exactly helped, have they?
Negotiations have been going on bilaterally, so it is not true that all the Arab nations surrounding Israel have refused. Peace treaties have been signed by Egypt and Israel. So it isn't that they refuse to negotiate. It's just that the process is taking unconscionably long.
Do you want to come back on this?
Professor, I wasn't asking you about the negotiations between Israel and the Arab states between themselves, but how they might persuade, influence the Palestinian people to renounce violence. You haven't answered that question.
Oh, how they might do that. Oh, I think that the... First of all, by example, it's a question of negotiations. All you're saying, in effect, is that the Arab nations have not succeeded in persuading the Palestinians to renounce violence. The very fact that these states have, for instance, abandoned the theology of the destruction of Israel. Some of them have actually done so. They've abandoned... Oh, yes, they have. They have. Saudi Arabia even proposed a plan of action whereby collectively the state of Israel would be recognized in return for the surrender of occupied lands. I mean, these are no mean gestures.
Could you just say who you are, would you mind?
Yes, certainly. I'm Andrew Tunick. I'm a member of the Lead Zionist Federation. The professor's lecture was interesting, but I heard very little about two things. Firstly, the responsibility of Palestinian leadership by removing their population's own dignity, by telling their children to commit homicide bombings, by having parties giving out sweets and toys after many Israelis have been killed. And most of all, of course, what about the dignity of the victims? Nothing is more undignified than going through a hospital and seeing bits of a baby's body with mobile phones, the dead person still ringing. Dignity is not just on the terrorist side. What about the dignity of the victim?
Well, if you know, in my last paragraph, you'll notice that I insist that we cannot succumb. In other words, I'm saying you're preaching to the converted. We cannot succumb, I say here, to acts that unilaterally abrogate our own rights to dignity and life. We are in agreement over there. The most recent example, that child who was sent off, bribed to wear a suicide jacket, wired jacket. Yeah. For me, this is one of the most repulsive acts in modern terrorism that we've encountered. I find it as deplorable as brainwashing child soldiers in the civil wars in Africa and sending them out to war to confront bazookas and cannons. They don't even know what the war is about. The degradation of youth anywhere in the world is, for me, a crime against humanity. Anybody who goes out, and this is why I use the word the innocent, that's why I speak of Madrid. It's an attack on the dignity of others. And we have a right to protect ourselves and to demand the punishment of those who are responsible for this. So there's no excusing under any sense of historical offense, historical humiliation. There is no excuse for removing also the dignity of the others.
Gentlemen. Jack Mapanje, honorary fellow, Leeds, now teaching at Newcastle University. I am a student of yours, Professor, from the earliest poem you wrote, Telephone Conversations, to the beatification. And one of the things I have admired is how you yourself have maintained your dignity. And you are not the only one I know. There are also politicians like Nelson Mandela and various other writers that we know. All I want
would
is...
Would I not be right in saying you were one of them?
but I'm more of a student of Professor Warren.
Well, I think I should make people aware that, in fact, you were imprisoned yourself by Hastings Banda, weren't you, in Malawi? Yeah.
Yes.
For late 80s.
Yes, but we were relying on the work that Soyinka and others had actually written about. And one of the things that I still don't want to be dissuaded from asking my question.
I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to do that.
My question is, are there any strategies, perhaps at a personal level, you might like to share with us as to how you yourself, Professor, have managed to hang on and establish your own dignity?
That's one question for which I wasn't prepared. Well, I think conviction has a lot to do with it. There's no point going about any cause of action or putting oneself at risk if one did not have an all-consuming conviction. Once you have that and you're aware of what, shall we say, the other side is trying to do to you, then you are able to create your own world and make sure that it's a hermetic existence which is not breached by those whom you identified as the enemy. Conviction is the main thing. Also, I think the knowledge that you really want nothing for yourself, you know, well, beyond your regular glass of wine, you know, that sort of thing. But basically that you don't want much for yourself.
Wale, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Next week, for the fifth and final lecture in this series, we're travelling to Atlanta, Georgia, which for the past 5 years has been Professor Soyinka's academic home. Not, as you'll know by now, a man who pulls many punches. He's called his final lecture, "I Am Right, You Are Dead." For the climax to this series of lectures on the climate of fear, join us in Georgia at the same time next week. For now, from Leeds University, my thanks to our audience here and to our Wreath Lecturer 2004, Wale Soyinka.